Well, good morning. I'm Sharon Kick. I'm the Director of Educational Services at Stevens Hospital in Edmonds, which is a town just a little north of Seattle. I have a degree in Applied Behavioral Sciences, and that's pretty much the background I come out of in terms of the kinds of presentations I've been doing last week and this week. I've worked in a variety of places. The job I have now is a Director of Education in a hospital, and I've worked in hospitals in Seattle and in Edmonds. I was also a Director of Outdoor Ministries for Lutheran Camping around Lake Coeur d'Alene, that area, for about 4 years. I was Assistant Dean of Students at Gonzaga for a couple years, and I've been an employment counselor. So I have a variety of work kinds of skills, but all of those in some ways related, for me at least, related to my interest in adult development. We talked yesterday, well no, it wasn't yesterday now, it was Monday, about the development of the self concept. And what we're going to talk about today is self-esteem and how self-esteem serves the maintenance of our self-concept, and in fact sometimes serves to help us, sometimes serves to hinder us. But primarily we're going to talk about why it's important to maintain good self-esteem as a way to continue to feel okay about yourself. There are some handouts here in the front, so if we want to just send those over so that they'll have the outlines. Okay. Anybody who was in the course on Monday or Tuesday have any questions or comments as you've thought about development of the self-concept? We can just take off from where we are, right? Okay. Primarily, the distinction you want to hold in your minds is that the self-concept is how we think about ourselves, and self-esteem is how we feel about ourselves. So most of the things we talk about today will be how feelings serve to keep our ideas about ourselves constant. When we talk about how does self-esteem function in personal development, the first thing that happens, of course, is that self-esteem is essential for survival. And you can see this. We talked mostly when we talked about the development of the self-concept about infants and young children, because that's where the self-concept development starts. However, as I shared with those of you who were here for that session, much of my development of my self-concept has also taken place as an adult. So even though we sometimes talk about it from the point of view of what happens to an infant, there's a lot of us that all those things don't happen to us as infants. And even with the self-concept that we get when we're young, we even then need to update that self-concept as we are adults. So many of the examples that we have for development of the self-concept sound like they're about babies and infants, but the truth is they're also about adults. When we talk about self-esteem in terms of survival, when you think about it for a little kid, you know, a little child, it's, you know, literally the movement of the child sort of moving away from the parent, developing a sense of him or herself, and then when something happens, coming sort of crying back to the mom or the dad and telling them what went wrong and being soothed is about as simple and practical and visual a way we can think of in terms of self-esteem. That literally they fall down and hurt their knee and they come back for soothing. They go away and play with their friends, and their friends say that they don't like them anymore, and then they come back and the parent soothes them and nurtures them. So that self-esteem in some ways is, in terms of maintaining feelings about ourselves, is as essential as maintaining a vision or an idea about ourselves. What happens as kids get a little older is that they then self-esteem becomes a way for them to compare themselves. So it's like my family says I'm this, but when I go to grandma's house, I get in a lot of trouble. Now, when I go to grandma's house, the expectations are different, and then I feel bad. And when I go to school, I'm able to do things better than I thought I was. So in some ways, my self-concept is raised. So that one thing that self-esteem does, that is our feelings about ourselves, allow us to, as we begin to make independent judgments about how we're doing, is to compare ourselves to another picture we had of ourselves, sort of an old idea we had, or compare ourselves to other people, or compare ourselves in terms of our behavior in more than one place. What children can learn is that they can do things at home that they can't do at grandma's house. And they can keep themselves from sort of getting in trouble because they modify their behavior because they want to continue to feel good. The flip side of that, of course, is a kid who has been told from infancy that he's bad. And ironically enough, those children, when they get in situations where someone tells them how good they are, will literally go back and try to repeat some bad things so that they can remind themselves again that they're bad. And I think we'll get to that a little when we talk about the repair process. But that's why it's all those things about it's important not to tell kids from the beginning, particularly in schools, that they're bad, because they will, in fact, begin to repeat that behavior because they want to maintain that sense of a self-concept. So self-esteem can either serve to support a good self-concept, or a negative one. And when we're going to talk tomorrow about how to change the self-concept, if we find that in some ways our belief system about ourselves isn't adequate, it's not, it isn't adequate to manage an adult life, it isn't adequate to manage the complex kind of situations we're in. And in fact, we may have been sort of, short shrifted early on in terms of getting a concept of ourselves that wasn't as full as the kind of people that we are meant to become. I've touched on that the function of self-esteem is to preserve the self-concept. If you start with a fairly good self-concept, then what you want is a feeling system that matches that. And for most of us, the cycle goes like this. Like, we have some sort of an experience. We do something. And if it's successful, we have success. Then we feel good about ourselves. Then we have another experience, and we have some more success, and then we continue to feel good about ourselves. What happens sometimes is that, all right, now we have an experience, and it's not successful. Instead of going back into this same cycle, when we're going to talk about the repair cycle, so we have to do something else. It's like something has happened that has sort of shaken our sense of who we are, or shaken our feelings about who we are. So we have to do something to get back into that, good experience, feeling successful, feeling good, another good experience, feeling successful, feeling good cycle again. The tricky part about self-esteem sometimes is, as we talked particularly about the negative situation, is that you could get a kid whose experience is being bad, gets in trouble. At least that feels consistent, gets, sort of bad, gets in trouble. That cycle goes and goes and goes. And then somebody says to this person, I think you would be really good at singing. Here's them sort of talking, here's them on the street, sort of wants to pull them out of this old sort of bad cycle. But that's a sort of a shock to that person's self-concept. It's like he never thought of himself as a singer before, never thought of himself working in a group, only thought of himself as a kid who sort of gets in trouble at school. So those processes of changing our self-concept, our self-esteem, can sometimes keep us down instead of raising us up. Does that make sense? Anybody have any questions or comments just about how self-esteem sort of... It's like the self-concept is in charge. Self-esteem is meant to keep the self-concept constant. Questions or comments? Anybody have a story they'd like to tell about?
So if the self-concept is negative, mm-hmm. like if a person has been raised from childhood to think that they were not a good person, that they could not do good things.
That's right.
And they get to be an adult, and they get to be in their 40s and perhaps in their 50s, and they simply repeat behavior that reinforces I'm a bad person.
Yes.
Like, for example, stays in an abusive marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what they deserve, right?
That's right.
How, and you'll maybe talk about this in terms of repair, how do you address that person's problem? How do you help them see, you don't belong in this situation. You don't deserve this. you are a better person than this.
Yeah. Well, it is real tough, and that is what we're going to talk about that both when we talk about the repair process today. We're going to talk about that more when we talk tomorrow about how you change the self-concept. Yeah. So, unfortunately, we won't get to that fully until tomorrow.
Okay.
But that's a good description of how that happens. What?
Stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned. Okay. All right. Any other questions or comments? Okay, let's specifically look at what the repair process is. The goal of the repair process, again, it's like you go sort of chugging along and life's going the way it's supposed to, and something goes wrong. And it's like for a kid, he has a test in school, thinks he was going to do well, just got a terrible, terrible score. Person starts a new job, thinks they had a great success at their last job, suddenly in this new job, there's new people, they just don't seem to be hitting it off well. It's like they can't quite figure out what are the rules in this new organization. That's an example for a kid and for an adult of sort of attacks to our self-esteem. It's like we're not so sure of ourselves anymore. Our sense of ourself in this new situation or this new organization is disrupted in some way. The repair process is to do one or all three of the things listed on the outline, and that is return to the nurturing source, participate in an activity, or use fantasy. And I'm going to talk about each of those. Again, if you use an example of an infant who goes away, falls down, comes back, and gets a hug or a kiss, that's the simplest way of seeing the nurturing object, the nurturing source. Often what will happen is that people then, especially you again see this with infants, is that they begin to develop transition objects. So a kid will have a blanket, and so then instead of having to come all the way back to mom, makes a beeline for the blanket. Older kids, school age kids, may go to their room, turn on the music, may find a place outside, a place in their yard, a tree house, which becomes for them the nurturing source. I think the nurturing source can be tricky. We're going to talk about, it's like when the nurturing source is a negative one, what happens then is that instead of returning the person to good self-esteem, it may do that momentarily, but it doesn't do it over the long haul. So adults have developed sometimes other kinds of nurturing sources, like drugs and alcohol. Sometimes things. Sometimes sort of sitting in the Winnebago or sitting, if you've just remodeled a room, you might go back and sit and go, I really do. This is a wonderful place. So the nurturing source sometimes moves from a person to an object, and the trick there is to be sure that object also has the potential for nurturing. We're going to get into that a little more when we talk about activity, but primarily the nurturing source is when you feel bad, is there a person you can go to or a place you can go to that is so secure for you and where you feel so whole that your sense of wholeness can return? That your sense of being cherished, that is the belief that you are lovable and capable, that those are the two primary issues again. That your sense of being lovable and capable is there. For most people, it does start with a person. And for most people, there we still need some person who can do that. But at some point, even without the presence of a person, people can still return to a nurturing source. Sometimes prayer and meditation can be that the person, is the person of God. Because you've used that whole sense of somehow the generosity of God as a way to feel whole again. So people would read supportive kinds of scripture. But you won't be able to do that unless you've had in your system somewhere a person who was nurturing, who helped that, you know, helped you develop that process and develop those skills. Now, the part that I think is difficult is that, again, it's like when the, if you go back to the child again, when the child goes away and comes back, if what the child hears is, oh, honey, that really was hard, you know, I can understand why you would be afraid, that's nurturing. If what the kid hears is, big boys don't cry, you know, go to your room, that, you know, you shouldn't have, you know, if it's a fight, it's like the kid gets in trouble, that's not nurturing. And so many of us have so many of those examples in it that oftentimes, even as adults, we return to people sometimes, or it's our idea of sort of getting ourselves in shape again, instead of saying kind and loving and nurturing things, is to sort of call ourselves up to speed. It's like, well, you know, that's stupid. That's stupid that you wouldn't know what to do. I mean, you've done this job before. You know, get in there and try harder. Sometimes people actually have friends they go to, and instead of, again, hearing the nurturing, it's like, well, you know, if I had a new job, and, you know, I would be just as confused as you are today. And, you know, sort of helps them figure out, goes, that would, instead of hearing them and understand that situation, would diminish the situation or would discount it in some way. What happens is that then we have instead of having a nurturing source, we have a critical source in the place of the nurturer. And again, that becomes a place where you think, you know, I ought to be feeling better. It's like, you know, I ought to be sort of getting some control over this. But in fact, you know, you continue to feel sort of worthless and hopeless and helpless and without any energy and without any sense of resources. And I know many people whose critical side, you know, whose critical parent is so internalized that they literally can't tell when they're not getting support from other people. It's such a foreign experience to them because their own parents were very critical. They've grown up critical. They are critical in their environments, and they really believe that that's how you help people and that that's what would be helpful to them. So when we work with adults with self-esteem problems, we talk about how important it is to find the nurturing source. And then we, you know, really ask you to think about when you're feeling real crappy, you know, who do you have in your system to go to? And try to remember, you know, what does that person do with you or for you? And one of the things we find is that people who constantly have self-esteem problems is that their primary nurturing source is often a very critical source, not a nurturing source at all. So the single most important thing that we do when we feel bad is to return to the nurturing source, and it may not be a nurturing one. So I'm going to stop for a minute. We have to remember that we have another group on the other side because you can't talk real loud. But those of you who, you know, for whom talking with someone helps you get clear, do that. For those of you for whom sort of being quiet and reflective, go ahead and do that. But think about when you're feeling down, what takes the place of that nurturing source for you? What does that? And if you know the names of people, you know, just jot them down somewhere in your memory, or because you want to know who and where that is. You particularly want to know who and where it is because when you go into new situations, you just know that your self-concept is going to be a little shaky, and you can actually schedule ahead of time, you know, to meet somebody for coffee after work the first day on a new job, or after you take a big exam to get in graduate school. You can plan those things, but you want to be sure that it's a nurturer, you know, not somebody who's that real critical one. So take a couple minutes and see if you can identify what your nurturing sources are. So to remember where you were, because we'll keep returning to this group so that you can get some help. Again, some of you, we did learning style things last week, and people who are introverts usually would prefer to be quiet and sort of think to themselves, you know, how does this affect me? And extroverts have to start sort of talking out, well, no, it wasn't this one, and no, it wasn't this one. And so we probably have a little of each in the room. How many people found a nurturing source somewhere out there? How many found some critical ones out there somewhere? Yeah. And they usually have wonderful names. Mommy, daddy. No? Food? Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, under activity, we'll get into some of those other buggers. One thing that I, particularly because I've been involved with so many people with career change kinds of issues or other kinds of change issues, is that the nurturing source might be someone at a certain time in your life and might be someone else at another time, or might be someone for a certain issue and someone else for another issue. You know, it's like you might be married to a very nurturing person, or your best friend might be a very nurturing person around almost everything. But if, for example, you're going through sort of some sort of a major career shift and you're the primary breadwinner, your spouse might not be the most nurturing person. Doesn't mean that they've suddenly become the ogre, but what it means is that the very thing you need to be nurtured about is the thing that they're most afraid about. And that can happen, it happens more in interdependent relationships, but it can happen even sort of with, it's like people you think it shouldn't make any difference, like your best friend who doesn't depend on you for money or anything, and you begin to talk about some major changes, and those people can, in fact, be threatened by the changes that you talk about. And it has something to do with the kinds of overlapping boundaries that we experience. It's like, oh my God, if you change, then I'm going to have to change. Or if you change and I don't change, that means there's something wrong with me. So you want to be attentive to the fact. It doesn't mean that you just throw a whole category of folks into the side of they don't really love me very much. What it might mean is that the very thing you need to have developed is the thing that they are the most afraid of, or the most affects them at this point negatively. We think about that a lot when we work on sort of self-development and assertiveness training for women. And some of you, you know, may have been sort of hit during the craze when every woman in the world went running at 5 o'clock when she used to cook dinner. You know? It's like that became the time of the day when we could run, right? It was after work, or if you have little kids, there's an older sibling home to watch the baby. And I don't know. I mean, I don't think it was a plot. But 5 o'clock became the time, which meant an enormous interruption in, you know, what everyone else in the family had expected as this lovely routine, you know, dinner on the table. That's an example of, you know, it's like the people in your system who normally are, you know, fond of you, real supportive of everything you do, the very thing that you wanted to do, that you've made this real decision that this is the only time you can do it, interferes with their need system. So suddenly they're not very nurturing at all. And they, you know, sort of whine and crab around the house. And you know, the potential for your self-esteem going down on the way to you're trying to bring it up is real high in a situation like that. It's real important, I think, then, to understand the function of the nurturing source. What I believe about the nurturing source is that the nurturing source in terms of people is someone who loves and cherishes in him or herself the thing you most need to learn next. A person who loves or cherishes in him or herself the thing that you most need to learn next. So if you're working toward more independence, you don't want to find somebody who thinks that his or her life would fall apart if they didn't meet everyone's needs. Because you're working toward another level of understanding yourself. Does that make sense?
Say that again, Sharon. You're saying that if I have a real need for independence, and that's my real need, I don't want to talk to somebody who's totally dependent and can't understand what independence is all about.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or somebody who's dependent on you being dependent on them.
Even more of them. Yeah, sorry, don't talk to them. It doesn't mean you don't tell them what's going on. It doesn't mean you don't share information. It just means that you don't use them as the nurturing source. Because they're sort of scared when you do that.
Yeah, pastors have that experience where if they start to, at least this pastor has it, and when you try to look to your people in your own parish for that, sometimes they get a look, almost a panic on their face.
Yeah.
If you try to ask them, you know, you try to project that you're needy at all
yeah.
To them. You know,
yeah.
And
You could, yeah, you could just feel them move away.
And the same thing was true with me, Sharon. When I made my career change from the parish to something else, the pastors that I had looked upon as my biggest nurturing source up to that point were simply not affected because they couldn't see, you know, how can you leave the parish? How can you not be a pastor anymore?
Because they couldn't imagine how they could.
They couldn't imagine themselves doing that. You see. Or in a couple of cases, maybe a little bit of, gee, I'd like to do that, but I can't admit it to myself.
That's right. Yeah. And it's important that it's like for you to somehow not junk all those folks, but to recognize.
Sure.
And often what happens is when we're doing that, it's like we don't know that that's exactly what we're doing. It's only in hindsight you sort of knew that you were into some new kind of development. And it's only in hindsight sometimes that you can go back and pick those folks up. The most important thing is to be very attentive to your feelings about yourself. And when you're with someone dealing with an issue that seems real fragile to you, do you leave that situation feeling more whole? You know, feeling more capable. That's how you'll know whether you have a nurturing source or not. And some people, you know, it's like with this sort of understanding, go, oh, I am bereft of nurturing sources. It's not too late to go find them. There are lots of people out there who just would love someone just like you because you're just like them. See? And they're waiting to find someone that they can see somehow a reflection of themselves in terms of that very same growth. But it might be a very different support system than you have developed around you already. Very likely to be very different. Okay.
Just a comment there. Do you think that some pastors sometimes put balls between themselves and their parishioners and they can't relate to their parishioners? As a nurturing source?
That, you mean because the
pastor has problems, he can't go to his, when the congregation is afraid to reveal himself to them?
And why would he be afraid of that?
I'm not sure. I'm not a pastor. That's crazy. So the pastors tend to have some do.
Mm-hmm.
The distance between themselves and their parishioners.
Mm-hmm. Why would that happen, if we're particularly with the issue around the nurturing source?
Well, if the pastor has needs, why wouldn't he go to the congregation?
Mm-hmm.
Because the image is the reverse. Mm-hmm. Now, there are a few pastors that I have known that that's how they function, is that that their congregations take care of them. And they are really quite ineffective pastors, both in the pulpit and elsewhere. But everybody loves them. They just keep giving them all of this stuff, you know, and they don't do anything. They don't do very much except get taken care of. But that in itself, turns out, I'm talking extremely. But I think that what Chuck is bringing up is that where a pastor won't do that is because if he or she sees themselves as a nurturer and has done that, and then something happens where they need the nurturing, marriage breaks up, child is dies, mm-hmm. All these kinds of things, that they can't, that requires a switch in consciousness, and you just don't do that. You may go somewhere else for your nurturing source, but you don't think of yourself. It's kind of like a doctor going to his patients and saying, you know, I need heart surgery. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to the extent that the pastor stays in the role of being the nurturer.
That's a lot to do with self-concept.
Uh-huh.
You know, the concept of yourself as pastor, how you view that makes a lot of difference in how you're going to relate to the people. If you see that you as pastor have to be the person who's in front, you know, separate from, you know, leader, shepherd of sheep, those kind of images, it's really hard. Then you put your own barriers up, but you really are saying, as long as that's my role, that's who I am. And how I feel about that may be good or bad, but that's who I am, and I've chosen that.
Nor should you, because I think you have people in your parish, speaking as a pastor, you have people in your parish who are constantly nurturing.
That's right.
Especially if they are supervisors, or they are in any, or lawyers, or judges, or doctors, you know, anything like that. Where do those people go? accept to talk to their pastor.
I think Sharon has a much deeper issue than even that. I think it's an ecclesial issue. I think the church can't handle that. I think by definition the church will not and has not addressed that. As a healing community, it's not a matter of my egocentricity or my lack of self-esteem. Mm-hmm. It's the church, by its very nature, can't handle the relationship that would exist between a pastor in need and its ability to nurture. I just think it's a larger issue of what does it mean, what has it meant practically speaking to be the church? It has meant that the pastor is here and the people are here, and the pastor nurtures the people as sheep, shepherd to sheep. Mm-hmm. The roles are never reversed.
Uh-huh.
It just doesn't
happen. And it may be that imagery, if as long as we continue that imagery, we'll never get past that.
That's right. I really don't think we'll get past that. I think pastors have to seek another source outside the congregation for that nurture, or pick someone in the congregation, a trusted friend that they can go talk to and be real human. I don't think they can be real human and expose the transparencies of their life from the pulpit. It just simply is suicide.
I think the key word you said is trust. I'm a pastor's wife, and I think that, and we have developed in different parishes a couple of very close friendships that we have maintained to this day. But not many that are there that close, because there aren't very many people that you want to share very many things with. I mean, it's not right to share a lot of them, and a lot of them you wouldn't even share with them, but I mean, even things about yourself.
Doesn't become an intimate relationship with 500 people or 1,500 people. So that sort of undoes what the very purpose of intimacy is. But on the other hand, to see that, you know, in congregational life, you know, there is sort of a role for the pastor, which may in fact be to be the nurturer, and there is a role for the congregation to use the pastor as the nurturer and to nurture other people. On the other hand, there are always both situations and individuals in those roles who will sort of rise up out of that and who will say, you know, I'm not just the nurturer around here. You know, I'm not perfect, and I'm not going to be able to listen to everything, you know, that gets said all the time. And I think it does have to do with sort of how you understand yourself in that role as well. Yeah, Willie?
Moving away from the parish a little bit, and I'm trying to understand the nurturing role, do people then gravitate to a major nurturer, and then they have minor sources for different sorts of areas? There can be more than one nurturer, certainly, but is there a major person in their life then that usually takes that role?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that. We could ask how many people. I think that when we're really talking about someone who can help you grow, you know, and who is, you know, sort of loving and kind, some people may develop whole systems around themselves of nurturing people, so that in fact the nurturing source may not even be just one person. Maybe a group of people.
And it may change throughout life.
And it may change throughout life. Because the nurturing source doesn't have to be the person with whom you're the most intimate, or two or three people with whom you're the most intimate. It can be simply an invitation to sort of become more of your best self. And that can happen in community. I mean, it can happen in, you know, apart from just, you know, one particular individual.
So it's different.
Uh-huh.
Couldn't the same thing though is, I hear like several people here that have been pastors or are pastors now, but it seems to me it's not just the pastor, it's in business, if you're a supervisor, it's the expectations everybody has of you in that role through just, you know, the same thing. They expect you as a supervisor or manager to be the nurturer. And it's, you know, all you're doing is creating this continuous disappointment if you expect it to be otherwise. For the most part, you know, that it's that way. And so that the easiest thing is to seek your nurture elsewhere, be it the church. Mm-hmm. You know, the expectation, I guess, is always higher, that the church should be above that, and the people in there should be able to rise above the situation, but I think most people have that concept of the minister as just able to handle everything at all times. And that maybe the best thing is for maybe the church and being different in a sense. Maybe they need somebody else in the church to do it. I would think it'd be extremely difficult, and most of the time a person would be looking for a lot of disappointment to go back to his parish or people in congregation.
Well, I think it has to do with what Jim described first, and that is that sort of shock that the nurturer needs something from you. And I think at an adult level, we can deal with that. It's like many of us have friends. So I mean, we need things from them, they need things from us. So at an adult level, but when you get into a sort of a role issue, it is, I think the experience is like when a kid comes to the parent, just bereft of something. And the parent is more upset than the kid. It's like then whose job is it to take care of whom? And that happens a lot. I remember the situation of my brother went to camp. And it was the first time my brother had ever... I have a brother who's 15 months younger than I am. And apparently it was the first time he'd ever gone away. I mean, I must have felt like it was the first time he ever went away. And I was just heartsick because Ricky was going to be gone for a whole week. And so I was just crying and crying. And my mom was more upset than I was. I remember she's going like, what do you think you're doing? Don't you think I'm upset about this too? Like, oh, God. And I hadn't thought of that until I, thought about this stuff about self-esteem. It's like, all right, have your turn. All right, you cry then. Because what I wanted was my mommy to tell me that Ricky would be back on Saturday morning and we would drive right down. It was the first time he'd gone away from her too.
That's what you see in adult children and have elderly parents who have been nurturers and they become dependent and become frail and require and sometimes observe all too often, unfortunately, is that where the adult children become angry with that frail parent and abusive verbally, if not physically, because mom or dad is needy, and
I'm the one that gets to be needy here. Yeah.
Right. See, and even though I'm 65 years old, and I have an 85 year old mother, mother is still she can't do that.
Yeah.
I wish she'd die.
Yeah. So I don't have to feel so bad. Yeah.
I feel guilty because I want her to die.
Okay, a couple more comments and we'll move on. Right.
I was going to say, one of my problems, and maybe other people's problems, is the people that I want to be my nurturers are not, when they aren't, then there's, like my mother, I've always wanted her to be a nurturer, and she's been the critical source. And to some degree, my husband, too, because it seems things probably, the thing about being threatening
Yeah, I can already see your disappointment. It's like we're really disappointed when that happens, aren't we?
Yeah.
We just feel real abandoned in some way, because we had some sort of an investment, and this person would be the one.
You keep going back.
Yeah.
Trying to make the person.
I think at some point you just have to know. I mean, I think that's why it's helpful. Like sometimes that's why theories are helpful. You go, oh, I get it. I want something very much from this person, because it's like, I always grew up thinking mom would do that, or husband would do that, or kids would do that, and suddenly you find out they're not going to be able to pull this off. And I do think there's a grief process that happens with that. Either that, or you could just hate them, but that's, it's not very satisfactory. I mean, the alternative to grieving that loss is that you think it's their fault. It's just a loss of something we wanted very badly and didn't get in that place. But it doesn't mean that it isn't there in the world for us somewhere.
There's the opposite, too, where you want to be the nurturer.
For example.
and you have Mitch, although you question whether we may have been the critical source, too. And then when you are not able to be the any source at all, you can also be grief.
Lots of grief about that, yeah. because they need to go away and find other nurturing sources at those times.
You don't always
appropriate
nurturing sources.
Oh, I'll bet. Okay, there's a comment here.
Well, about being the parent and being the nurturer, the thing I have with my children sometimes is they're getting older. When they come to me with emotional pain, I nurture them, they get over it, and I'm still upset. And they're all healed, and I'm still fretful about it. You know, it's hard for me to let that go sometimes.
Yeah, then you need to find someone to talk to. Yeah. I remember an incident. My son told me some terrible thing had happened at school. I mean, I remember he was in the fifth grade. And I mean, he was just furious about something. It's some great, you know, they're into injustices in those years. And so I got, you know, like you, I just got furious. I said, oh, I'm going to call your teacher. And he said to me, he said, if you do that, I'll never tell you these things again. I went, oh, I get it. That wasn't my problem, was it? He only wanted to tell me about the injustice. Didn't want me to write it. I loved it. You know, if you listen to the kids, they'll help you do this right. But if you do that, I'll never tell you these again. Oh, I get it. That was your problem, wasn't it? Okay, hope they're quick.
Sometimes it helps just to let your nurturer know what you need to do, what you need from. Like,
yeah.
I'm a counselor, and I used to tell my husband, look, I got to come home, and I got to blow it. And I don't want you to do anything. Don't do any problem solving with me. Just listen, and then I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, he would have picked it all up and said, oh, my God, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
I just need to dump it, and I want you to let go of it.
Yeah, but stand here so that I know I'm not talking only to myself.
Yeah.
I'm surprised. You haven't mentioned yet, I think he's one of the greatest nurturers, either critical or supportive in the world. That's your supervisor. Or if you're a supervisor yourself, your subordinates, you're nurtured to them. I mean, to me, when you do your job, and you do a good job, and your boss praises you for it, that's one of the greatest boosts to self-esteem there is.
It certainly, yeah.
It's almost the other way around.
That's right. If it doesn't, it isn't.
Is that true?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that can be a good nurturing source. Okay. Let me move on, because the second thing, and again, these are the idea of getting these down is that we can make conscious choices to move toward the nurturing source. Another alternative is activity. And I, as an adult, finally recognized I didn't have anything that I could do. I mean, I got more messages about being lovable than I got about being capable. And again, in most families, sometimes there will be a split, and your family system may have lots of messages about you're okay if you do certain things, you know, and you are a capable person. You know, others will give messages about just being lovable. I mean, we just love you because of who you are. And may neglect, in fact, that sense of, you know, what your accomplishments are, what your real skills are. So the second thing that we do as a way to nurture ourselves, and when our self-esteem is low, is to have activity that we can do that helps us to, usually the activity has more to do with feeling capable again. The nurturing source may be more about the lovable, although it can give you information about that you're capable again. But again, good examples of this with kids. Your kid is on the swim team, just adores swimming, but has, you know, for 3 weeks in a row, broken curfew. So what our tendency is of course, to take away the thing that he or she most loves, because that'll have some effect. Unfortunately, what happens is when we take away the activity that the kid gets his self-esteem needs met from, then their repair process breaks down. And I mean, and I know that's difficult, but we have to find a way to punish or discipline or set limits that doesn't take away the repair process. And that's the one we go for. It's like, you know, what do I have clout about here anymore? Well, we know what he likes, we know what she likes, so we'll tell them that they can't do that anymore. If you've identified that that's part of your child's repair process, and if you value it, you know, again, you know, you could have a kid who's got a negative self-concept and whose repair process involves negative activities, and you do want to interrupt that. But if you've identified that the repair process is in this particular activity, then do something else in terms of punishment. I mean, the one about the little kid in school who just wiggles and wiggles and wiggles and just gets in so much trouble and then is kept in from recess. I mean, give yourself a break. Don't do the work. I mean, that kid ought to go out twice, you know, every morning and twice every afternoon. But it's like if you're the teacher and the only moment of privilege in the day is recess, and you go, okay, no recess for you. And you just, so you just missed it. I mean, that kid gets outside, runs, sees his friends, begins to feel good again about, you know, whatever it was that was making him real squirrely to begin with. So I think that, you know, I think that's a tough one. And for ourselves, I mean, I know that there are times it's like when I'm not doing well, I deprive myself of going to see friends. If I don't have money, I deprive myself of going to movies. I mean, it's like the lower my self-esteem is, the more vulnerable I am to not planning good activities for myself or doing those things that are really nurturing. It is just, see, it is really, you know, when the self-esteem stuff gets down, it's very difficult to pull those things back out, which is almost why a discipline of visiting the nurturing source, you know, keeping in contact with those people who really value you, and a discipline of the kind of activity that, again, makes you feel good about yourself. A new hobby, because it has to do, usually, in many cases where you can see something done, you know, has a beginning and a middle and an end, and you can look at it, or begin to, it's like, you know, sports or activity or something where you get going something outside of yourself and feel some sense of accomplishment again. So for all of us who neglected activity, it's time to, you know, learn one. And again, you could, if you get into activity with your real critical mind again, you know, you can, and you're not perfect, that won't be your self-esteem builder. You know, so if you have a tendency toward being a perfectionist and really push yourself at stuff, you have to find an activity where you can't fail. You know? Where you can't use that again to, you know, to feel unsuccessful. You can't fail watching TV.
Can you name someone?
Well, it's like all you have to do is figure out the ones where you can lighten up on yourself about. I think the thing to do is to take a class in something you don't know anything about. So your expectations of your success are so low that anything you do is just a delight. I took a stained glass class one time. We didn't even finish the project. I mean, but I was so happy to be in a place concentrating on, you know, sanding and gluing and all of this stuff, and I didn't have to do the any things that I had to do normally. And there was no question but that I was not going to do well based on some external value system. So I think it's like to start something new. Or just to watch. I mean, if you're real competitive, start something that's solitary. You know, instead of playing tennis, tennis might be the one. But if you tend to be competitive, then you want to do something where you're not going to be, you know, sort of pulled into that part of yourself.
Would be doing something that you continually have successes be something, you know, that you've always done well at?
Yeah. In fact, when we talk about fantasy, again, what we do in fantasy for nurturing our low self-esteem, the idea again is to go back and remember things you've done or moments you've had that were successful. You know, that's worked sort of on the like a kid, you know, has some sort of an event, you know, either has a fight with their friend, and sometimes, so the fantasy either can be to remember a time when that, you know, he or she and the friend got along really well and had a nice time, or sort of imagine how if that same situation came up, you would handle it differently. You know, the part where we leave meetings and we say, "God, I should have said this and I should have said that." That's sort of our fantasy taking care of our self-esteem. It's like we didn't do as well in the meeting as we would have liked to, so in the car on the way home, we think, "Well, now actually, if I had said this when she said that, then that would have happened and I would have felt a lot better about that." And that's perfectly legitimate. You know, in terms of self-esteem, it's like to redo the event in your imagination and sort of get yourself a successful event in your mind. What happens then often is that you're reprogramming yourself so the next time you might do it differently. But even if you don't, even if you're simply visiting another good time, you just had a terrible thing happen, and you visit another good time in your life, that has the effect of reminding you again that you're a good person and that you're capable. And so it might not even have anything to do, it might not be anything content-wise like this at all. It's like you might remember your last vacation. You might mentally just take yourself to the ocean and, you know, watch the waves. Again, now that's one with kids in school, the teacher yells at them for something, and then they start looking out the window and they go, I wish I were out there. You know. And then she yells at him again, is life more interesting out there than it is in here? Well, yes, actually. It's true. Yeah? And then that's sort of a mini example of the kid did something to, sort of help his self-esteem and got in trouble for it. That's when, when we talk about that, that's an example of the repair cycle. And doing those things helps repair you when you have a negative experience. The problems with the repair cycle are sort of twofold. One, it's like if the repair is so bad that you spend all your time in fantasy or all your time in activity not related to, or all your time with this friend who just really adores you. It's like if the repair process takes too long so you can't get back to the activities of your life, then that's obviously a negative. What it often means is that the repair process is the self-esteem problem is in the center of your life. It's in something that you're doing all the time. Your example of the supervisor at work. Many people go to work every day with a supervisor who is just on them all the time. And, or kids go to school every day with a teacher who is just on them all the time. And those are really serious problems of self-esteem. Because if you can't get away from the damaging, problem, then you're always in the repair process. And the issue then is to try to change that primary event. Get yourself into a different department at work. Get your kid out of that class into a new class. Talk with the teacher about how your child learns better. Get yourself out of that relationship. That's if the center of your life is the harming point, you don't have enough time left. You don't have enough energy left to spend all your time in repair. And it's also a way that you might be able to tell. It's like, I'm always wanting to talk with so-and-so. I don't seem to be able to make any decisions by myself without talking to, this person. Or where we also notice it in terms of activity is, it's like instead of those good activities is eating, drinking, all of those avoidance activities are also activities that for a moment helps us with our self-esteem. We feel better for a little while. But the cumulative effect of that is that we are less and less effective in terms of managing our lives, less and less effective in terms of managing our feelings about ourselves. And so those are real negative ways of repairing ourselves. Unfortunately, they may be the ones that we have models from our families, from our friends. They may be the ones that we learned. So we need to break some of those cycles because those don't ever get you back to feeling successful and feeling good. It's like then you feel worse and then you do it again and you feel worse. And those are some people are talking about those as addictive kinds of cycles. And often what that means is that there's some part of you that's that really is self-destructive. There's some part of you that just can't seem to shake that negative self-concept or negative self-esteem, and in fact goes to those negative sources as a way to almost ensure that you're not going to get out of this, that you're going to stay, the abusive relationship kind of stuff that we talked about before. It's like you're committed to that mindset about yourself. And that's where under the problems with the repair cycle, then number one, if your repair activities aren't good activities, that's a problem. And if your self-concept is low and your repair activity is sort of doomed to keep you feeling low, that's a problem. And I think ultimately it's the question is, how do people sort of come to terms with that? I think as we mature and become adult, even with our very limited self-concepts, we start looking around us and going, I don't think everybody lives like this. I don't think everybody's as miserable as this. You know, I mean, I can't be, I mean, I can't, it can't be that I can't do anything right. Or even that friends will say, it's, you know, to you, you know, you seem to be miserable more than half the time. It's like, and you sort of, you know, you start sort of moving in with people about, it's like, why is this so important to you? You know, someone talks about someone's judgment. Some people are just in crisis all the time, and you know that it's not a crisis that's out there. It's sort of a crisis of sort of managing their lives. And I think that it is useful for friends to say, you know, it's like, you just take way too much on yourself. You know, it's, it isn't going to serve you. You know, you don't have to do that anymore. But for many people, it really becomes a matter of pointing out their pain or intensifying their pain or acknowledging their pain before they'll let go of the cycle.
But you see, that's a cognitive understanding. I think people who are adults in body, who have been told from the time they were born that they were no good, have a pygmy-like emotional stance. And they can say, yeah, this isn't right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know that's not right. But they can't move themselves out of that situation because emotionally they just are still in the infancy stage. And I mean, they just are not able to, they're paralyzed.
The
head says one thing, but the gut says another. And the gut controls.
My experience of that has been, in terms of nurturing sources, that somehow through my life have come, you know, maybe 5, 6, 8 people who for some reason just loved me very much. And sort of, you know, one drop at a time, you know, helped me to believe that wasn't, it's like whatever it was that I had inside of me wasn't the whole truth. And they've done it in a whole variety of ways. And they've come at very different times in my life. I mean, I think that it's like when you see someone, you know, with whom you identify in some way, and yet you see that there's just a part of them that's just, you know, just down there. The commitment to confronting them and to saying something and to letting them know what it is you really cherish about them, I think is a real corrective experience. I think over the long haul, I mean, if people at some point, you know, people with low self-concepts become relatively dysfunctional. It's like they can't hold down jobs. I mean, their families are just in great chaos. It's like life will help you with this stuff if you give it a chance. It's like your kids will get in trouble, and then you'll get hauled into the juvenile court, and then they'll send you to a counselor. Or, I mean, there are levels at which life will provide enough crises for those of us with low self-esteem that there will be opportunities to somehow get jerked out of that and get sort of drawn up to snuff. And I think in terms of really changing your self-concept, the best way to do that, I mean, is in therapy, where you have a really healthy counselor who just consistently does all those things that would have had to happen in the development of the self-concept. They mirror back to you that you're okay. They help you understand the difference between thinking and feeling. It's like it's really a whole sort of a rebirth kind of a process. But we can all participate in that, both with people we care about and sometimes practically with strangers. You know, somebody you just see for a short period of time who somehow you have a sense that the source of their problem is that they don't see themselves the way you know that you see them. And I think we are sort of called upon to sort of call people up out of that. And my own experience has been that, you know, it didn't take cast of thousands. No. But it did take some people. It did take some, you know, for me, it went real nurturing sources. I think for some people, really significant activity can do that. And you think about kids whose self-concept is low who do very well in some skill. And that simply boosts their...